Now, throughout recorded history, philosophers and religious people have created lists of qualities that are described as a good person. The Beatitudes of Jesus are one famous example of such a list. In the 19th century, character became a key word in the vocabulary of Americans. Character referred to a group of moral qualities. A person with a good character was the type of person needed to maintain the social order. 19th century writers produced hundreds of books, pamphlets, and articles on the subject of character, providing examples and promising worldly success for those who developed good character. One cultural historian reviewed 200 of these publications. The focus was usually on a higher moral law. The most popular quotation, it appeared in dozens of works, was by the Unitarian minister Ralph Waldo Emerson, his definition of character. Emerson said character is, quote, moral order through the medium of individual nature, end quote. The words most frequently used to describe a good character were citizenship, duty, democracy, work, building, golden deeds, outdoor life, conquest, honor, reputation, morals, manners, integrity, and above all, manhood. Obviously, men wrote these 19th century books about good character. 200 years ago, when men were writing about good character, a woman had no right to own property, no legal existence apart from her husband. Yet the law held women responsible for all the debts incurred by their husbands. Women had no right to attend public meetings or to testify at hearings or to run for public office or to vote in elections. Yet the law required women to pay their full share of all local and federal taxes and obey all the laws of the state. In churches, women had no right to vote or sit on governing boards or committees or serve as ministers. Nevertheless, society expected women to uphold the virtues of modesty, meekness, compassion, and piety. One way this prejudice against women manifested itself was in comments made about the sound of a woman's voice. Consider, for example, this passage by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's writing about his friend, the great transcendentalist thinker, Margaret Fuller. Emerson said, "I can still remember the first half hour of Margaret's conversation. She was then 26 years old. Her extreme plainness, a trick of opening and shutting her eyelids, the nasal tone of her voice, all repelled me. I said to myself, we shall never get far." The nasal tone of Margaret Fuller's voice repelled Ralph Waldo Emerson. Or consider the experience of Reverend Olympia Brown when she was studying in school in the 1850s to become the first Universalist woman minister, really the first woman minister in America recognized by a denomination. Reverend Brown wrote, "My fellow students at the seminary, all of them male, indulged in derogatory remarks about my sermons. There were two young men who pride themselves on devising various petty forms of annoyance. For example, they would get under my windows at night and mimic my voice, which they found peculiar." They found the voice of the first woman minister peculiar. So yesterday morning I Googled the sound of Hillary Clinton's voice. These are the headlines I got. The science behind hating Hillary Clinton's voice. Why do so many people hate the sound of Hillary Clinton's voice? Something about Hillary Clinton's not-so-attractive voice. People are still complaining about Hillary Clinton's voice. Media personalities ridicule the volume of Hillary Clinton's voice. Well, I wanted to be fair, so then I Googled the sound of Donald Trump's voice. I found no such negative articles. The closest I could come to a negative comment about the sound of Donald Trump's voice is a video with the headline, "Cat hears Donald Trump's voice and runs away." So today, when I hear comments about Hillary Clinton's voice, I think back to what Emerson said about Margaret Fuller. I think back to Olympia Brown's story of how male students in her seminary made fun of her voice. Another of the ways prejudice against women is manifest in the 19th century was in comments about women's assertiveness. Margaret Fuller, for example, after pushing very hard, became the first woman to be allowed to use Harvard University's library. Imagine being a woman and not being allowed to use a library. Assertiveness like this on her part led her friend William Henry Channing, a Unitarian clergyman, to write Margaret Fuller a letter telling her that she was arrogant. Well, I don't have Channing's letter. I just have Fuller's response. She wrote, "Henry, the word arrogant does not indeed appear to me to be just, probably because I do not understand what you mean. But in due time, I doubtless shall, for so repeatedly have you used it, that it must stand for something real in my large and rich and yet irregular and unclarified nature. But though I like to hear you and think somehow your reproof does me good, by myself I return to my native bias, and I feel as if there was plenty of room in the universe for my faults. And I feel as if I could not spend time in thinking of them when so many things interest me more." Well, more than 150 years later, this is still an issue for women leaders. Dr. Deborah Tannen is a linguist at Georgetown University in Washington. She spent her life studying this. She writes that we tend to judge individuals in position of authority by how they carry out that authority. And this creates a particular challenge for women. The way many in our culture expect women to talk is at odds with society's idea of authority. Many of us expect women to call their beliefs opinions, to hedge their statements. We expect women to seek opinions and advice from others. We expect women to be polite when they make these requests. However, if a woman talks this way, the way traditional society expects her to talk, people see her as lacking in authority and therefore a weak leader whom they cannot trust. On the other hand, if she talks with certainty, if she doesn't say, "This is my opinion. She says, this is a fact. If she interrupts others, if she goes on at length, if she speaks in an aggressive manner, many people will call her arrogant, just as Margaret Fuller was called arrogant in the 1840s. And arrogance is only one of the words that others might use. Our language is rich with words to describe such an unwomanly woman. Words used to describe many prominent women in authority. Dr. Tannen writes that anyone who seeks public office, especially the highest one, the presidency, must be ambitious. Yet people rarely apply the word ambitious to male candidates because people take that for granted. Ambition is admirable in a man, but unacceptable. In fact, downright scary in a woman. So I Googled yesterday, Donald Trump ambitious. I found this. Trump is proud and ambitious, and he strives to excel, to stand out, and be recognized for who and what he is. I found this. A true businessman and entrepreneur, he overcame financial difficulties in the 1990s through ambitious real estate developments. Then I Googled Hillary Clinton ambitious, and I found this. She's a cynical, grasping, and ambitious politician. Other headlines accused her of naked ambition, unbridled ambition, ruthless ambition, and even of being pathologically ambitious. Then I found a satire in this, a spoof on the website The Onion, with the headline, Hillary Clinton is too ambitious to be the first female president. So in our country, many of us expect a woman running for president to obey two mutually exclusive character expectations. One expectation for any presidential candidate is to be a good leader. The other qualities of character that many Americans look for in a good leader include forcefulness, confidence, and at times the ability to express anger. These are qualities of character we value in men. The other expectation for women is to be a good woman, to be gentle, to be modest, to show emotion, and not express anger. These are qualities of character that we do not value in presidential candidates. Therefore, if a female presidential candidate displays qualities of characters expected of women, she risks being seen as unqualified. If she displays qualities of characters expected of a president, many will see her as too aggressive. She will be subject to the many negative words that are used to describe women. Indeed, as we have seen in this election, some feel that a woman who acts like a man should be locked up. Dr. Robin Lakoff, also a linguistic professor at the University of California, Berkeley, says that this accounts for the persistent impressions of Hillary Clinton as inauthentic and untrustworthy. When people do not talk, when they do not act as we think they should, we do not trust them. A woman running for president may have qualities of character such as toughness that we require in a president, But because she is not talking the way we expect a woman to talk, we do not trust her. Linguists have conducted research on this for 40 years, learning how the rules of conversation, the rules we first learned as children, influence how we feel about male and female roles. For example, conversational rituals common among men often involve joking, teasing, and playful put-downs. Those of you who have attended our committee meetings will often see me engage in this activity with the other men in the room. Conversational rituals common among women are often ways to maintain an appearance of equity. I see these conversational rituals played out in our church gatherings every week. Linguistic research has shown that men use conversation to help establish status. We want to appear in control. Therefore, we men are less likely to ask questions in a public situation. When asking a question will reveal our lack of knowledge and show we have a weak character. Women ministers ask, "Why did Moses spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness?" Because he wouldn't stop and ask for directions. In his book entitled Thinking Like a Champion, Donald Trump is proud of the accuracy of his gut instinct. He says that within a few seconds of meeting someone, he knows if that person is 100% solid, someone on whom he can count. He also has met others to whom he has an instinctive aversion, and he writes that his gut reaction is always right on those occasions. So like Moses, Donald Trump does not need to stop and ask for directions, not at least in public. When speaking, we expect women to downplay their certainty or to risk being called arrogant. We ask women not to say they're certain of certain facts. Instead, we ask them to say, "This is my opinion. I wonder what other people think." On the other hand, we expect men to downplay their doubts or risk being called weak. This is the truth. It starts in childhood. Researchers have studied girls at play. They have found that girls who seem too sure of themselves are unpopular with other girls. In contrast, we teach boys to put themselves forward, to emphasize the qualities that make them look good, and to de-emphasize those that would show them in a less favorable light. We call boys who do this confident. We call girls who do this aggressive. Of course, around the world, this is all changing. During the past 50 years, many women and men have moved beyond this narrow prescription of roles from our past. For example, in English-speaking countries, Margaret Thatcher became the first woman to serve as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom in 1979. The current Prime Minister, Theresa May, is the second woman to serve in that position in the UK. Kim Campbell became the first woman to serve as Prime Minister of Canada in 1993. Helen Clark became the first woman Prime Minister of New Zealand in 1999. Judith Gillard became Prime Minister of Australia in 2010. I visited England in the summer of 1981, and twice I sat in the visitors' gallery of Parliament and observed It was my impression that although there were strong feelings expressed on the issues of the day, people had accepted, indeed seemed to take for granted, the fact that the prime minister was a woman. Years later, at a political event in Auckland in 2007, I shook hands with Prime Minister Helen Clark, and it was thrilling for me to meet the first woman prime minister of New Zealand. The country was functioning well under her leadership, and the Auckland Unitarians were proud of their country, proud that it was led by a woman prime minister. Now, I realize that you are a very intelligent group of men and women, and some of you are thinking that this sermon would have been more appropriate in 1975, when Dr. Robin Lakoff first published her work about the differences between men and women in conversation. Or perhaps this would have been a good sermon for me to give 26 years ago in 1990, after Deborah Tannen's book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, was published. This book, after all, was on the New York Times bestsellers list for 4 years. And for 8 months, it was the number one nonfiction bestseller. That was 26 years ago. So it may feel to many of you like I am covering old ground. However, not everyone reads the books on the New York Times bestseller list. I want to talk about this today, not because this research is new, but because this election is the accumulation of a cultural revolution that has been going on for nearly two centuries. For the entire history of our nation, for more than 200 years, white males have led our country. Then in 2008, a majority of voters in our country elected an African American as President of the United States. A significant minority of Americans have found this very upsetting. Change is not easy. Despite a Hawaii birth certificate, 20% of Americans sincerely believe that the president is a Muslim who was born in Kenya. Still, in 2012, a majority of voters in our country reelected an African American as President of the United States. In the same way, in this election, many Americans still find the prospect of a woman president very upsetting. And they are looking hard for reasons to find fault with her. We are witnesses to what has been, for the most part, a peaceful cultural revolution over 200 years. We can trace the beginnings of this revolution back to the 19th century and women like the Unitarian Margaret Fuller and the Universalist, the Reverend Olympia Brown. Today, this cultural revolution continues. It is not easy. It is not over. However, the times, they are a-changin'.